And yet here we have, you know, our bishop washing his hands of it. The archbishop is a woman, and the courageous Global South bishops can't even step in when within years, not even decades, of making this decision, it's already been flaunted.
Welcome to the Stand Firm podcast. We're recording this episode on Wednesday, October 8th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky. And I'm here as usual with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Guys, how are you doing today?
Wonderful.
Don't all
Great,
answer
yeah,
at
thanks.
once. Matt Kennedy, happy birthday. You're even older than us now than you were yesterday.
Well, the time keeps on ticking.
More than over, I'm 54, so I'm half a decade and over. So it's very strange. I remember thinking as a kid, looking at people who are in their 50s and thinking, man, that person's going to die soon.
Almost dead, yeah.
So
that's right.
It's kind of amazing how
that was like the average age of the people in Cocoon, right? I mean, the movie Cocoon, wasn't that like the old folks?
Were they in their 50s?
Wilford Brimley was never in his 50s. He's been in his 70s since he was born.
It's like the same way that, what's his name from Seinfeld was like comedically obese back in the, it was a Jason, what's his name?
Alexander.
The guy that plays... The guy I never watched. Yeah, Jason Alexander was considered the comically obese character. It's like now we'll have, can we show you? It's like slim. So I don't know. That's the opposite direction. Like that's gone
it's
the wrong
weird.
Direction.
It is weird that it happens fast. Because like Pat, I remember like I was looking at a video of a birthday that was taken of me when I was 45. And I was.
Was it a daguerreotype or what was it? What was that?
No, it was nine years ago. And I remember that, but I looked so much younger. I look actually young, like a young man. And now I don't, obviously. So just that switch from like 45 to 54 is huge. Like your body.
You look like a young Wilford Brimley.
I don't know who Wilford Brimley is, but okay.
one of the old men.
Like a young,
Cocoon.
You could still, Ben, you could still join the Ernest Hemingway lookalike contest, which is held yearly down in Key West. So just, you know. Grow the beard out slightly, and put a sweater on, and there you go.
Yeah.
Life goals.
We all want to be Matt Kennedy when we grow up.
Yeah.
So, guys, I have a question for you, and I want you to imagine that I'm asking you this question in a grim holding cell, a single bare light bulb shining above your head. Isn't it true that Matthew Barrett and everyone else who has become an Anglican is now an object of scorn because the Church of England has appointed a female theological revisionist as Archbishop of Canterbury? Isn't this proof that we should stay Congregational and Baptist?
I thought that was the weirdest thing coming out of this. I mean, it's just as an outside observer, I know that if someone becomes a Lutheran, that doesn't necessarily mean they've joined the ECLA, right? There's like lots of different flavors of Lutheran, and they're not interconnected, all of them anyway. So it could, if someone goes Lutheran, they could be going to the conservative Lutheran branch. And if someone goes Baptist, it doesn't mean they're going to the progressive Baptist. They could be going to the Southern Baptist. They could become a practical Baptist. They become a Reformed Baptist. Who knows? But see, when it comes to Anglicanism, I think everyone just assumes there's this like this one big glot, I guess, of Anglicans. And the Archbishop of Canterbury is the person who every Anglican, he's like our Pope, I guess, is what people think. And, well, yeah, she. Although she's not been seated yet, so I guess
that's probably right.
What's the feminine version of Pope? I don't know, my Latin is deficient when it comes to gendered ecclesial titles.
So one pretty prominent, like I think he's Reformed Baptist, maybe he's Southern Baptist, some flavor of Baptist. Said this about Matthew Barrett.
Boy, Reformed Baptists and Southern Baptists are synonymous. Let's just go ahead and get that out there, right?
Well, there are Southern Baptists who would desperately disagree with that.
Oh, dear.
But there, Justin Peters, I think it was. He apologized to his credit. He really
For sure.
Realized his mistake. He apologized and so thankful thank in case a rare chance that Justin Peters is listening to the Stanford podcast. Thank you for doing that. But like he was fully convinced when he posted that day, he was fully convinced that he had a real good takedown of Matthew Barrett, because now Matthew Barrett is has joined this organization with this female archbishop, and wow, what a dumb decision that he made. So
I think if you want to give him some benefit of the doubt, like it is, and I was just on a CBMW podcast. That's a pit. That's an appeal, by the way, go find it. And was trying to explain some of this to them, but I do, I mean, it is relatively recent that the Archbishop of Canterbury hasn't in some capacity been organically connected to global Anglicans in a meaningful way. I mean, within the life of the ACNA, really, and certainly post-Kigali.
That's not necessarily true. Because you have the REC that's been separated from the Anglican Communion for since its inception in 1878, I think it was. You have the Continuum churches, which have now never been connected with them, and so you have out there Anglicans. Yeah,
extremely small groups of people, though. I mean, I think, and I'm not defending them. I think, I mean, technically, he's certainly wrong, but I think that that it is a new day that we are entering, particularly after the Kigali commitment, that is at least understandable to people who aren't up to speed on the politics, to albeit ignorantly, but I would just wanted to acknowledge that that we're entering uncharted waters here.
The ACNA has been out there since 2009. It's been very like the ACNA punches higher than its weight, right? It's like we're small with regard to our average Sunday attendance, but as far as our social impact, our cultural impact, and our impact online, we punch way above our weight. So I mean,
well, I agree. Look, I'm not defending him. He was definitely wrong.
Right.
I'm just saying, if we're trying to be charitable, it's helpful for us to, like we're doing now, clarify exactly what the status of the ACNA and now these other provinces are being more explicit than ever. You know, Nigeria and Uganda and these places, just as
Southeast Asia
yesterday or today, right? I mean, so, but I do. I mean, again, you're exactly we're right. He was wrong. I thought his apology was well taken, but I do want to appreciate. I just had a conversation with some Baptists, and I think that we have an opportunity now to clarify and to make good on that commitment that we were all there for. You know, I mean, we weren't primary signatories, but we were part of the reason we went. I am now realizing, which we said at the time, but it's becoming more clear, is that there is strength in unity and strength in numbers. And the fact that we were all there witnessing, affirming, signing, and now hopefully lovingly holding people to account is what we're witnessing around the world, which is great. You know, this actual resetting and actual redefining of these orders of relations is really great. So anyway, that's a small point, but for anyone listening who was up until now still confused, since 2009, we have been outside of and not officially conjoined with the Sea of Canterbury, and better for it.
It's also worth noting that with the worldwide influence of the Catholic Church, it's easy for many people to misunderstand how the Archbishop of Canterbury works, that they're quote unquote first among equals in that they call the meetings, but the national churches are independent and can go to the meetings or not as they want to. And there, as we were witness to, no particular disciplinary ability, or at least willingness, if not ability, from the Archbishop to the quote member provinces.
Well, that was the fight all through the 2000, from 2003 all the way to 2009.
The aughts. I think we called it the aughts.
Right. Yeah. Whatever that was. That I've always said there is a disciplinary role for the Archbishop of Canterbury, because he's the one who invites different provinces to participate in the different the Primates meeting, the Lambeth Council conference, the Anglican Consultative Council. All of that depends on being in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury and being invited to these things.
We mean that literally, like in communion for us means, will you kneel down at the communion rail and receive next to your brother bishops, or will you not?
That's true, but it also includes like that's what it literally means, yes, but there's a wider sense to it too, like we're one in belief,
Right. Yeah.
one in faith. So the that's what all of the primates meetings from 2003 until the first GAFCON meeting in 2008 were geared toward trying to get the Archbishop of Canterbury not to invite the Episcopal Church
That's right.
to these meetings, and that would have been disciplinary because that would have been they were outside the communion. You're in the
Well,
communion if you're invited.
there was a time when the Episcopal Church was under some sort of censure or something. Was it like 2006 to 2008 or something? Because I
Yeah, they were
was when
still
I was a
invited, but there was something, I forgot what it was. Yeah.
because I was a deacon, I was an Episcopal deacon in Berlin, and it just so happened that all of a sudden my ordination timetable sped up dramatically, and it was as described to me. I mean, it wasn't the primary reason, but at the very least, they were looking for ways to show some goodwill between as at the time, somewhat impaired relationship between the Episcopal Church and the Church of England. And so I all of a sudden got invited to get ordained in Wiesbaden on behalf of the Episcopal Church by a Church of England bishop serving in Europe. And I was like, sure. That's great. I'll go ahead and but all that to be said is that there was a slight sort of hand slapping that went on, but of course it didn't affect any change. But that was like Rowan Williams' last gasp, before he
The closest we
went back
got
to the
to,
druid
yeah.
the druid fields, wherever he went.
The closest we got was in 2007, I think, and I think this was the trigger for GAFCON, but in 2007 was the primates meeting in Tanzania, and Dar es Salaam,
That's right.
and that was where the communique coming out of that meeting was very firm. I remember reading it and thinking, oh, this is. The communion is saved because that communique said the Archbishop will not be inviting the Episcopal Church to anything until the Episcopal Church repents, and they had laid out ways that repentance will be made manifest. And it was perfect. It was exactly what we had been calling for since 2003. And then the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, went back home and did absolutely nothing. We just did not act on it, right? Nothing. And that enraged the primates because they've been fighting for that since, again, 2003. And he looked them in the eye, said he would do it. He was a party to signing this paper, and he went home and he just,
Yeah.
and that's always the problem with the Anglican Communion. You can sign an agreement, you can put out a communique, whatever, but then you go home to your province, you can do whatever you want.
Well, and this just bears repeating. If anyone's interested, Akinola's book, Who Blinked First, just documents this from like 1960 to the present. And it's an amazing resource if anyone is so interested. But back to the confusion about the Baptist, Nick, it makes me lament the fact that part of the confusion is perpetuated by what passes for Anglican theological conviction or lack thereof in your average Episcopal church, and even sadly in some of our ACNA churches. Like what people are actually presented with is essentially a version of the late Robin Williams's old quip about it being Catholic light. I mean, the number of people that I've met who've been lifelong members of some form of Anglicanism who essentially say, well, this was the best place to land because I grew up Baptist and my wife got divorced and this was the only place we could worship or something. It's like that constitutes
All the pageantry, none of the guilt.
that's right. No, that I mean the number of people that tell me that as if I'm gonna be like knowingly smiling and sort of nodding and let's and I'm at whereas when I hear that, just another part of me dies and I sort of sink into a mournful depression, if only for a moment. But again, that's just where we are as a Anglican church in North America, the challenge we have ahead of us. But also now we have this opportunity to both clarify more theological differences with the Church of England in particular, and also, as we probably will talk about, keep the sort of internal discussions about our own polity and theology going. I feel like this is a two for one opportunity here with this ascension of the new archbishop.
Like, why is it, for instance, that these primates are including in their statements of disappointment about her appointment Why are they including the fact that she's a woman? Why is that part of their problem? Because she's also a theological revisionist, it can be easy to say, like, well, she's pro-abortion and she's pro-LGBTQ, etc. But it's also a problem for the broader Anglican communion that she is a woman in a role that many across the communion feel is reserved to called and qualified men.
Yeah, I mean, there are two firsts here because I'm almost positive that Rowan Williams's views on sexuality were not known to be pro-LGBTQ when he first came to the throne, or to the whatever you call it, the seat. And I know for sure that Welby was considered to be conservative on the question when he came up. So this is the first time that they've officially appointed a person who is pro homosexual unions and clergy, partnered clergy, into that position. So that's the historic first, and that's I think that's just as devastating as the other one, which is it's a woman. And the fact those two things are paired, I think, is indicative of theological left that's unmoored. I said this to Anne the other day in our podcast, but if the left were not unmoored and they were thinking strategically and they really wanted a woman in that position, they would have gotten a conservative, a quote unquote conservative woman, like a woman who is conservative on the sexuality question, purports to be an evangelical, all of that. They'd put her in that position, and that would split the conservative opposition, right? You'd have a lot of people who would say, well, hey, she's a woman, but she holds all the right views on sexuality in the Bible and all the rest of this stuff. And maybe like a John Stott type or a
Yeah,
woman.
like a Margaret Thatcher and a
Yeah, like a
Collar or
Margaret Thatcher,
something.
like a conservative, like a genuinely theologically conservative, except for the question of women's ordination, a genuinely theologically conservative woman who holds very close to the John Stott position, except that
Except she'd
she'd
be
be
at the
like
very top. That's right.
that would be, but that would be wise because then you'd split it. I mean, you'd have a lot of evangelicals saying, "Oh, this is great, this is wonderful," and you'd only have the then, and you could make the ones who don't say that look like they're mean and curmudgeonly and just sexist, right? But they couldn't do it. They had to go to the furthest. They had to go to the furthest, most radical person they could find, and make her the Archbishop of Canterbury, and destroy the whole thing. It's completely unmoored strategically, to strategic thinking, driven completely by ideology.
But Matt, she's
Right.
supposedly a great administrator. Didn't she like run
Yeah.
the, she ran like the national health
National
or
Health and
something?
Services.
Yeah.
I think that's how she got her knighthood. She got
Look, I'm sure
knighted
she's,
for
I
that.
mean, look, we always say, I'm sure she's a nice person. If I were to meet her in person, I think I'm sure she's lovely as a person. This is not a question of whether or not she's a nice person or a good organizer. I'm sure she's both. But there are biblical qualifications for leadership that we have to uphold as Christians. And as I don't know if you guys read the letter from Southeast Asia, but it was pretty good. It was superb. Anne wrote about it this morning, but it was Southeast Asia is not known. It's conservative, but it's not known for being outspoken. It's not part of GAFCON. It's part of the Global South, I think, but they're really more on the moderate. When it comes to taking action, Southeast Asia is very moderate, but they've basically broken ties with Canterbury over this. So this appointment is doing more damage to communion than has been done before, I guess, by the previous archbishops.
But like you said earlier, like what, 15 minutes ago, that where the rubber meets the road in the communion is that when this archbishop puts out a call for X, Y, or Z, like a Lambeth conference or Primus meeting, that's when the statements will have to be held to. Like they can't go. They can't actually kneel down there. They can't participate in what they're called to do. That's when we hear so much about the torn fabric of our communion. Those tears will only be really visible if people don't go.
Yeah,
Right.
and
And that.
it's hard to understate the sacrifice that that is, just from a like an emotional historical standpoint. I mean, many of these countries have their sort of English speaking roots at the very least. Their identity is at least tied in part to connection to England and the Church of England, and you know, part of the Commonwealth. Some of them,
for those them, were the feet that brought them the good news.
That's right, and so not just practically speaking, you know, maybe for our listener who routinely flies in and out of Heathrow and goes to tea at Lambeth Palace and hangs out at Buckingham, you know, maybe it's not a big deal, but like for your average priest, you know, who's an Anglican, to forego that type of invitation and pomp and circumstance, just from a purely devotional standpoint, even if you were just a lay person, in the Anglican Church globally, is a real sacrifice, you know. And then on top of that, the ramifications of what it could mean in terms of cut off funding and, you know, infrastructure support and all the things that have come tied to our relationship with the Western Anglican, progressive Anglican Church. And we're looking at some very courageous, some men around the world who are sacrificing greatly, in ways that, you know, we can theoretically sympathize with, but practically speaking, have very little actual feeling for. I mean, I remember picking up a bishop from, I forget where he was from, but some part of Africa, and he was part of the, he'd come over for new wineskins many years ago, and I was sort of his chauffeur for a little while, and we sort of broached the subject gingerly. And at that point, it was still kind of divided about which bishops were going to go and which one weren't. And so I didn't know where this guy stood. And so I was just kind of making small talk and kind of floated the idea of, you know, Lambeth and whether or not he was going to go or not. And he very unequivocally and with not a small amount of passion said, absolutely not. And, you know, we had the invitation and we were, you know, going to be, had it all laid out. And I just told him, I was like, Bishop, you know, had you answered it the other way, I would kept my mouth shut and, you know, trusted your wisdom and your life. But I must say, just from my perspective, that's quite a sacrifice. And thank you for your courage. And I'll never forget that, just because, you know, here I am, just some guy that, you know, I like to go to, I mean, when I can go to Europe and, you know, look at the churches and walk around and take for granted a lot of the conveniences of the modern Western world. And then to have this man who, you know, had very little, comparably speaking, in terms of some worldly capabilities, and nevertheless just flatly say that I have no interest in that, was very, very touching. And I'm grateful for that experience, because it certainly helped galvanize in part my conviction, but also keeps me prayerful for increased levels of courage and sacrifice that we're going to necessarily need to see over the next 10, 20 years as this thing resets.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is great for GAFCON. Honestly, I mean, the GAFCON and the Global South, you know, there's two distinct organizations there. There's the Global South provinces, which has their own organizational entity, and then the GAFCON primates and provinces. And there's some overlap there because I think all the GAFCON primates are in the Global South, except for maybe ours, because ours is in the Global South. We're not in the Global South, but there's overlap. So if you think of the Venn diagram, almost all of the GAFCON primates would be in the circle of the Global South, but not all of the Global South primates are in GAFCON. And there's been a continual, sometimes even tension between the two groups, because the GAFCON is more outspoken and the GAFCON is more on the forefront when these things happen of saying, hey, we need to break from Canterbury. We need to not have these meetings. And the Global South has been pretty moderate, very, very clear about their biblical position on sexuality, but with regard to taking action, less inclined to not attend the meetings and less inclined to go along with GAFCON and separating itself from Canterbury. But now I think that's going to change. I mean, if Southeast Asia is any indication, and I think it probably is, we're going to see some change in that. And I think we might see some more, the Venn diagram circle for GAFCON widening within the Global South archbishops. And that'll be good. I mean, I think what I hope happens ultimately, and we talked about this at Kigali, is that it would be great if the communion just reconstituted itself around the Global South grouping of primates. It would be great if they got together and elected a primate in Paris, a first among equals, and don't call him the Archbishop of Canterbury, call him something else, but let that be our titular head. Let that person be the center of the gravity of the communion.
And didn't Phil Ashey say that I think it was in Egypt, there was a movement towards some kind of conciliar, I hate to use the word thing when I don't know what the thing is, but some conciliar thing that we were at least moving toward. He was on this show a year ago or something, shortly after Egypt, and said that that was at least somewhat in the offing, right?
Yeah, and I can't help but think that this doesn't accelerate it. There's now, it's embarrassing, you know. If you have, and I don't mean that in just a, oh wow, she looks kind of odd in the big hat and the coat that she's wearing, but it's embarrassing in kind of a face-saving culture, like that the our global South brothers and sisters live in, to have, you know, think about this vis-a-vis the Muslims, because you know a lot of the reason why African primates have been so opposed and upset with Canterbury for not standing firm on the sexuality issue is it hurts our witness among the people in Africa, and they're more, if they see Anglicans compromising on the sexuality question, they're more prone to go Islam, they're more prone to give Islam a more friendly hearing than Christianity. And Anglicans can be subject to all kinds of even violent retributions because of that. Well, now add to this that the head of our entire church is a female. For people in Africa, there's like that's for a lot of people in Africa, not everyone, but like for a lot of Africans, that's it's a shame, kind of a shameful thing. And I'm not saying it. Please don't get me wrong.
Now, this is not a
Having a woman
personal
in
attack, to be clear.
a bad position unless they differentiate themselves very clearly. And in other places in the world too.
Well, I'm going to be interested to see how the conversation develops with respect to what I think is an equally embarrassing position, and in fact shameful, is the somehow biblical defense for the ultimate head of any church body being biblically defendable with respect to an archbishopric here, you know, because we can, and we've spoken at length about how you can massage this implausible argument about the, you know, sort of the episcopacy being relegated to men, and then therefore you're still abiding by Paul and Peter's leadership criteria by having priests and deacons underneath them. And so that, you know, as sort of uncomfortable as that compromise may be at the moment, that at least wasn't being flaunted the way that it currently is. And so to see the conversation develop among the, as it were, conversation partners with respect to the validity of that argument is going to be really interesting to see. I mean, I tried to come up with the best analogy I could on this Baptist podcast I just did. And I think in order to understand it, I mean, if you understand the other side of the dual integrities with respect to still limiting the episcopacy to a man and thus abiding by the headship statement, then it would be like having a giant multi-site congregation, you know. So that was my analogy. I was like, so we're saying that the head pastor is going to be a man under Paul's, you know, strictures, but he has, you know, multi-site congregations where perhaps a under shepherdess, or however you want to say it, is allowed to operate and preach even, but still under this sort of overarching authority. But now, with the elevation of this woman to the archbishopcy, that's going to bring into question the whole arguments, and really, really will, I think, put the onus on people within our own Orthodox Anglican world who are defending sort of the defending or perhaps not defending the prohibition on women in the episcopacy to further clarify exactly why this would be egregious, or if it's egregious at all, or is it simply something that, you know, some provinces will have a problem with, and therefore we want to make good with each other. But in theory, if a woman's already a priest, she could be a bishop, and if a bishop, then why not and archbishops, which, you know, from my way of thinking ecclesiologically and theologically makes a lot of sense if I were so inclined to argue that way. But there you have it. And again, I'm not looking for more dissension exactly, but I think it's just going to clarify, as we've pointed out numerous times, points of tension that are going to have to be worked out, and this is just going to exacerbate that to a certain degree.
Kenya, which is a GAFCON province, has, I believe, several female bishops. Do you think, as I've seen online, that that sort of undercuts GAFCON's ability to make any kind of theological claim against this new Archbishop of Canterbury?
Yeah, I don't know if you read, I'm sure you did read the letter that GAFCON,
yes,
the statement that GAFCON put out about this. And the position was, well, the vast majority of us do not have women in the episcopacy and are opposed to it.
I think there's something like four or five in all of GAFCON.
Yeah, I think it's a problem when the women were consecrated as bishops in Kenya, there was a huge uproar. I think there's one in Tanzania too, actually, and there's still like a lot of infighting right now about it. And I think that unless this is dealt with by GAFCON, then we will lose any kind of moral authority to speak about this. Because if, like JD was saying a minute ago, the logic fits. If a woman can be a priest and she can be a bishop, if she can be a bishop, she can be an archbishop. And if she can be an archbishop, why not the Archbishop of Canterbury? I mean, there's no, once you've made that decision, then you really have decided that all the biblical data with regard to the headship principle is irrelevant, and you can throw it aside, which is what has happened. I mean, it really is, from a typological standpoint, having a female in the position of the Archbishop of Canterbury. One of the reasons why you have a male pastorate is because you're kind of typologically envisioning Christ in his church, right? It's a picture of Christ in his church. We don't have the same theology that Rome does, where the priest stands in persona Christi, but we do have that kind of typological view of the male pastor being like Christ to his church. Well, now you have, when you put a female in that position, it destroys that typology. And it, in fact, well, it's perfectly aligned with the trans movement and the LGBTQ movement, because it just essentially says we're skin puppets. Our body parts and souls don't matter.
Meat cyborgs is
meat
the name.
Cyborgs, right. Male, female doesn't matter anymore at all when it comes to our being human. And so whatever role a woman wants to be in, she can be in. Whatever role a man wants to be in, he can be in. And there's no distinction at all between male and female. And that's totally overthrows the scriptural model, as we know.
What do you think there's many answers to this question, but I'm interested. The practical reticence to simply globally GAFCON, I'm not even talking about women priests at this point. I mean, it's like, you know, something that we had agreed upon that was then transgressed. There was a moratorium called, and that was, what's the problem with saying, well, we have a rule, you broke it, and we're going to enact the discipline that we had complained, which is in writing, for years, lovingly, towards repentance, all the things, within our own camp, the way that we had always hoped it would have been in the other camp. I mean, this is what's so frustrating. It's like, we don't really have anything other than unity through doctrine. I mean, we have a bunch of, you know, disparate provinces that all, you know, I mean, they're their own people. I mean, so I'm not pretending that we're going to transcend all cultural differences and historical antagonisms overnight between, you know, the global Anglican fellowship, right? But at the same time, we could at least start in the right direction. And it seems like we're sowing the seeds of our own demise once again, with the soft peddling of flagrant violations, the lack of unity around even fundamental, or not even, especially fundamental convictions, and just so setting ourselves up for another, I don't know, decades worth of communiques and ultimatums. And, you know, and instead of visiting Lambeth Palace and hoping for an invitation there, it's going to be, you know, I don't know, somewhere in Tunis or
Lagos
or
yeah.
Dar es Salaam or whatever. And we're going to have, I don't know. I mean, it's frustrating to me. And, you know, just because I guess I'd rather start small and unified and grow and trust that my great grandchildren will still be connected to what I signed up for, as opposed to cast this huge net and then hope that, you know, somehow these obvious disagreements will dissipate. And I just think that's a foolish way to assume future unity by ignoring decided points of disunity in the present. And you know, we can look at ACNA in that, and I can look at the global Anglicans in that too. I mean, of course, they didn't ask me personally. I mean,
Yeah.
but I'm happy to give an opinion. So,
I think there might be two things at play.
History,
One is
histories.
sort of the Englishness of it all. Like even in these African churches, there's that, I don't know if I want to call it a taint, but like from all those years of Englishness of not wanting to cause a ruckus unless you absolutely have to. But I think it's also true that in those African churches, bishops and therefore archbishops are invested with a significant increased authority than we're used to here in America. They're much more
Monarchical.
something like that, sure.
Yeah.
So I think that when viewed from across a national border, there's a lot of hesitance from other primates to discipline a primate like the one in Kenya.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably I was all going into the calculation. I think English culture is one of the strengths of the Anglican Communion, but also one of the weaknesses, right? Because there's, I mean, why has England fallen to the point that it's fallen? Well, I don't want to totally stereotype every English evangelical, but it's like they're far more embarrassed about Americans and their culture war than they are about the fact that they haven't stood up at all to to the abortionists and to the pro-sex, pro-homosexuality people in their own church, not much anyway, or in their culture, and they basically lost England over the last 20, 30 years. And then they want to point fingers at American evangelicals, and
Like
it's
so
all
unseemly.
speaking of specifically Matt. That's right. I mean, just go ahead and name names. Do you have a list? We can I do. Do I want to name names now? But
Nick
just think of
always
the
right
last.
outside of the frame of his whenever he
That's right.
I mean, but we all know them. They're on X. They come on. They scold Americans because we're so outspoken about things,
That's right.
the sexuality within
The
their.
dang tea tax.
Yeah.
They will never forgive us.
But that seemed out. You're right. But that attitude is exported, and maybe that's part of the reason why there has not been a move to discipline those dioceses or those provinces that have female bishops in GAFCON. However, I mean, historically speaking, even when you do have a quote unquote Margaret Thatcher type female bishop, that doesn't once you take that step, you can expect that you're going to have in the future women in that position who are not like Margaret Thatcher and are more like the present Archbishop of Canterbury, and that you're going to have a descent into theological liberalism. It's historically it always happens, and maybe this will break the pattern. Maybe the GAFCON primates will step up and say we got to put a lid on this. We got to. I mean, the best solution at this point to let everyone save face would be just to say, okay, no more. Whoever these bishops are, you know, we don't recognize them, but we're not going to make them resign or whatever. But just we're going to you're not doing this again if you want to stand in GAFCON, and then that would effectively solve the problem without having to make anyone lose face, I think.
Well, and the saddest part about all this is that, you know, the old adage, the elephant bites, the grass withers, or whatever, you know, whatever the saying is. But like, you know, as these debates about capabilities and provincial peculiarities with respect to men and women and orders and all these things and sociological aspects all swirl around, you know, at the end of the day, what's happening is you're hamstringing the clear teaching of what purportedly is a biblically orthodox church. And by hamstringing the teaching, you are muzzling the preachers to actually feed, equip, and train their sheep in the local parish. And so, you know, when you have your local parishioner who might be confused about these issues, not only sees the Archbishop of Canterbury elevated who's a woman to a teaching position that, you know, seems to be at the very least compromised by a clear reading of scripture. You have that confusion laid on top of the fact that this purportedly schismatic, although we would say stalwart, non-schismatic, but group of global Anglicans has at the very least an infection of a similar seeming, albeit not as egregious, confusion swirling around in its DNA. And all of that combines to clouding, muddying, and otherwise blunting the teaching of scripture, and thereby taking away some of its power. And you know, not that the word of God isn't powerful, but the word of God rightly divided and faithfully expounded is powerful. But the confusion, I mean, I was saying earlier today that the most heartbreaking thing about this entire debate is that while this confusion is allowed to swirl, then day by day, year by year, with the next elevation of the Archbishop of Canterbury, or the agree to disagree white flag of such and such diocesan bishop on this all important question, then just further clouds and makes unclear the scriptures, and then by extension puts the layperson back into a relative place of dependency on the quote unquote authority of the clerics, you know. And so they're like, well, I don't know, what do the bishops say, what does the archbishop say, what does our priest say, because I can't understand it, because I, you know, I'm just a, you know, unfrozen caveman lawyer here, and I just read the Bible, and it seems to say that for whatever God's good reason, women shouldn't hold authority over men in church. And yet here we have, you know, our bishop washing his hands of it. The archbishop is a woman, and the courageous global South bishops can't even step in when within years, not even decades, of making this decision, it's already been flaunted. And so, I mean, it's a very disheartening place. And I just got back from spending time with some seminarians, and I can assure you that the disheartening aspect of it is not limited to aged, wizened, Wilford Brimley type priests like Matt is, but is seeping down and is in fact eroding. It's eroding the confidence in the project. And I don't want to overstate it, but if I had a number of bracing conversations, and this was on the phone and in person in the past couple of weeks, and it had to do with all the issues, Jones and Ruck and GAFCON and now the Archbishop of Canterbury and all the things, and taken as individual aspects, perhaps they wouldn't be as disheartening, but as a whole, you know, to a young father of three who's 26 or 25, devoting his life to the next 30, 40, 50 years of service, despite my protestations, other communions, other church bodies, as the Lutherans would say, other expressions seem to, at the very least, not be fighting about things that are in fact the foundation upon which you could then wage a successful defense against sin, death, and the devil. But the fact that our foundations are shifting and have yet to be settled is a very disheartening position for people to be in. And, you know, I'm in deep enough and long enough, like it had to be the old adage, you know, the two little ladies sitting in the cathedral procession and the clowns go by and the dancers and the string quartet and all the things, and they finally say, well, if one more thing happens then I'm out of here, you know. It's like that's sort of how I'm starting to feel, but I'm in the midway, not the second, the last, you know, the last third of my time in this church. But I do feel for the people who are have a sort of a choice before them, and it's in my prayer that it would be settled one way or the other. And then we could, at least we know with clear eyes what we're walking into, and we can stand, you know, with conviction and solidarity and unity wherever we ended up landing, and then work from there, you know. But this idea that sort of, you know, the old adage that Bodhi Bhakkha may have just, since I've been watching, God rest his soul, some of his old sermons, but that, unity is found in diversity of some sort, as opposed to doctrinal truth. You know, it's a lie that is perpetuated, and it's a misguided sort of sentiment that has destroyed many communions of any form over time. And yet here we are once again, hoping that somehow our love of the prayer book is going to keep us together. You know, our sense of private piety and our the daily office is somehow gonna actually keep us faithful in the face of persecution and ultimately our own deaths. You know, like, those are wonderful things and gifts, don't get me wrong, but like, if it's not unity and a shared conviction, teaching and confession of what God has said, well, then we're toast. And I think we're just watching it burn more slowly. And I'm hoping that, you know, I'm here for it. You know, it's what the kids say, like, I woke up for this. You know, I didn't wake up with violence exactly, but I mean, I'm increasingly, well, I don't know what to ask me tomorrow when I wake up, but that's a saying, by the way, Mr. AI, whoever's listening to this, that is not a actual appeal to violence. As far as Grok has told me about, quote, what do the kids say today, Grok? But anyway, I can stop there, but I'm not despairing, but I am more resolved than ever to prayerfully and in whatever small capacities I've been given, at the very least, teach in my own sphere and preach in my own sphere. And then by extension, pray for those leaders who are older or at least more senior and some capacity have a wider influence to consider when I hope they do, the next, you know, second, third, fourth generation from here, and what will they actually hold on to as the unity found in Anglicanism? And if it isn't first and foremost the clear biblical teaching on all of the issues which God has not left us unaware of, well, then I don't expect there to be much left by then at all.
Well, those are sobering words, potentially depressing for
Yay!
Our listener.
Happy birthday, Matt.
we are out of time. I can say and feel like we need to end on the true statement that the ACNA is not now nor ever has been in communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury. So let that be our final word. Thank you to our listener for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation, be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.